We're holding 24th chapter, Pasuk Aleph. Avram is an old man, and the Pasuk testifies that God blessed Avram Bakol. What does Bakol mean? So one understanding our sages say is that Bakol is Gematria Bin. Girls don't like this, so girls rearrange the order of the words, and they say the Gematria of Ben is Kelet. The letters of Bakol is also Kelet, a dog.
What's Bakol?
Bakol is everything. Kelev are the same letters as Bakol. That's what girls like to say. But there's a medrash here which you could answer your sisters if they ever tell you that. The medrash discusses what does Bakol mean. So one understanding in the medrash is he had a daughter named Bakol. That God blessed him with everything. He even had a daughter named Bakol. Another understanding in the medrash is God blessed Avram with everything. He didn't even have a daughter. That was the top lesson. You didn't have a daughter. So you read that and you say, what does the Medrash mean by that? Doesn't sound too nice. So our sages explain. If you want to get your sister upset, you could just quote the beginning. But if you want to be a truthful person, you should quote the continuation of the Medrash. The continuation is that Avram saw that there weren't any young men out there that were fitting for his daughter. And he was concerned if he would have a daughter, he'd have to marry her out to one of the people he didn't want to marry her out to. So in his case, it was a blessing that he didn't have a daughter, because just like with Yitzhak, he had a problem getting him a good shidduch. He was worried if he'd have a daughter, he didn't see anyone out there that would continue his way, that would be fitting for his daughter. So that's what the Midrash means, that Avram was blessed with everything, that he didn't have a daughter, that even his request, so to speak, from God, don't make me stuck with a daughter that I can't marry off, even that request got answered, that he ensured he wouldn't have a daughter. So Avram is an old man and he can't head out to find the shidduch for his son, so he calls in his servant who's the elder of his house. Now there's one servant that we encounter once in the Torah, and his name is Eliezer, and our sages tell us that he's the one we're talking about here, but he isn't identified by name. He's called Ha'ish, he's called Ha'eved. Eliezer's name appears only once in the Torah. And everywhere else, our sages tell us it's talking about Eliezer. So over here also, the Pasuk says, Avram called his servant, who's the elder of his house, who ran the show, and he told him, I want you to take a vow, I want you to bring my son a wife, not from the Canaan daughters, but from my family. And what's going on here? First of all, where's Yitzhak? 37-year-old man, he needs his father to find him a shidduch. Yeah?
So the thing that
So our sages say, what does it mean his elder servant? One understanding is he's proved himself already, so Avram could trust him. Another understanding is that he was an elder, so Avram wasn't too concerned sending him with the girl. I mean, he's asking him to bring a girl back. How could he trust him with the girl? So another understanding is that's why he took the old man. And together with the other servants, he felt like he could trust him. And even then, there's a medrash that says that when they came back, the medrashim discussed that neither Avram nor Yitzhak were certain that nothing had happened, nothing improper had happened, and that's why the medrash says that Eliezer, the son of Nimrod, Eliezer the servant of Avram was the son of Nimrod, that Eliezer was one of those who walked into Gan Eden alive, because they didn't trust him. You're not allowed to mistrust the person. If you don't trust the person, you have to bless him. So the Midrashim discussed that Avram, one Midrash says Avram didn't trust him, another Midrash says Yitzhak didn't trust him, that when she came back with Rivka, they were concerned what really happened along the way. And as a sachar that Eliezer got for having to put up with this mistrust, he ended up in Gan Eden, alive it seems. And another understanding is why is the Torah stressing he was the elder? To tell us that he learned in his yeshiva, that's Eliezer, he learned from him. And he could trust him to do what he wanted. Yeah?
What is the difference between being alive and dead?
I don't know. Hands up. I don't know.
Buried in cars. Undead.
So, our sages say, he called Eliezer. Eliezer was a wise old servant. And Eliezer wanted his daughter to marry Yitzhak. So that's why when Avram tells him, I want you to go find a girl out there who's going to come back from my family to marry Yitzchak, Eliezer says, what if she doesn't want to come back? So Eliezer says, Ulai lo tovei aisha, maybe the woman won't want. And the Torah writes the word ulai without a vav. To hint us, the word meaning eilai, ulai without a vav is eilai. Maybe you'll come back to me, maybe you'll let my daughter marry your son. He wants to move up in the world. He values Avram. And Avram tells him, no, that's not going to work. You're from Canaan. You're from the family of Canaan that were cursed by Noah, and I need my son to marry someone from the family of Shem. Shem was not cursed. Yeah?
His family, Nimrod, is from Canaan?
Yes.
I thought he was from
Avram's born. We did this 2 weeks ago. If you want, we'll do it again in a second.
I heard somebody else say it was from Damascus.
And the Pasuk says.
The thing in the Hurtz says that I think a lot of biblical critics look at this and say, oh, it's going to see the Bible, and really quickly found out, wow, well, you know, Babylonia wasn't founded by Semites. Who would have thought?
Give me just a second. The pasuk says, Canaan had. Canaan had a son named Ham. Ham had a son named Cush. Cush had a son named Nimrod. So Nimrod was Ham's great grandson, and Eliezer was his great great grandson. You could see that in Perek Yud in Bereishis, from Pasuk Vav through Pasuk Ches. That's where we see that Nimrod came straight from Ham. Correct.
So he could put Avram in his
mother. So that we discussed then, and if you want, we could discuss on Thursday night. We went through that. So Avram is old, and he calls his servant who he could trust, this trustworthy older servant, and he tells him, I want you to take a vow. Put your hand under my thigh. So one understanding is that this was the custom then, and this is the custom till now, Ibn Ezra says in Hodu, in India, that you want a person to take a vow, you tell him, put your hand under my thigh, and you sit on his hand, and that's how he takes a vow. So to speak, I'm in bondage to you, whatever you want. Rashi quotes what our sages say, that when you take a vow, you have to hold an object of a mitzvah. And Avram, what object of a mitzvah did he have? He had his bris milah. And this shows us something very special. The Ramban in Igeres HaKodesh says that when a husband comes to be with his wife, so in truth he's coming to perform a mitzvah. No different than putting on tefillin. We're accustomed to thinking of certain parts of our body as, oh, that's what we do dirty things with. Okay, it's true, we do. But the truth is that that's an object to perform a mitzvah with. And if a person is on that level, then he views it as, this is the mitzvah I have. David HaMelech could sing a song thanking God for giving him this mitzvah that's sealed into his body. Avram tells him, I want you to take a vow. We also see that the Torah uses a specifically clean tongue, if this is what the Torah meant. So the Torah discusses it by allusion. Just like when the Torah discusses Yaakov's offspring, it says, Yotze Yerecho, those that came out from Yaakov's thigh. It doesn't mean the thigh, it means the eger that's right near the thigh. But it's alluding to it. By speaking about the thigh, it's speaking about near it. When we say that Shaul went to the bathroom, it says he poured out his feet. He didn't pour out his feet. It's another way of discussing, of mentioning going to the bathroom. So the Tanakh always uses a clean tongue as much as is possible. Yeah?
When he says angels have wings on their feet, is it referring to the same concept? I heard this from someone. I didn't know that.
So the Chazal tell us that they cover their feet. The pasuk says in Yeshaya, "Bishtaim yichaseh fanavu, bishtaim yichaseh raglavu, bishtaim yofeh." They have six wings: two to cover their face, two to cover their feet, and two to fly with. That's a pasuk. And there's another pasuk that says, "Raglehem yisharak echaf egel." Their feet are straight like the foot of a calf. And from there we derive that in Shmona Esrei our feet have to be put together like the feet of an angel, like their feet come together to form one. So to we, when we stand in Shmona Esrei, we put our feet together to be like the angels that are featured to form one. And our sages say that the reason that they cover their feet is because the feet are like the feet of a calf, and that would be, so to speak, a reminder up in heaven of the Jews' sin. And that's why prior to the Chet HaEgel they did not cover their feet, and after the Chet HaEgel they do cover their feet, so to speak, so there won't be a remembrance up in heaven of our sin. Now, what does all that mean? I don't know, but it does seem to mean that feet over there means literally feet when it discusses the feet of the angel.
I don't understand, how does the calf's feet come together?
So I'm not sure. I think what the Midrash means is that the shape of a calf's foot goes like this. So that's, I think it means the curve that comes down, the way a calf's foot comes down. I think that's what it means, but I don't know. It's a Gemara. It's a Gemara in Brachos. So he takes a vow. He tells him, do me a favor, bring him a girl from my family, from my homeland. And the servant says, maybe the girl won't want to come back. Should I take an agreement that your son will go there? And he says, no, don't you dare sign such an agreement that my son will go there. Our sages say, we learn from Avram over here, laws and shiduchim. And before we go through these rules for shiduchim, I want to give just an introduction about shiduchim in general. People sometimes read these rules that Chazal derived from this story, and they say, this is how I have to lead my life. And to a certain extent, that's true. Chazal were talking to us, they were teaching us things. But we have to know that whatever our sages say about shiduchim, we have to know how much weight to give it. Our sages say a person should always try to get a bas talmud chacham, try to get the daughter of a talmud chacham. If you can, get the daughter of talmud chacham. So I know people who don't go on a date unless they verify that the father is a talmud chacham, and they spend years not going out on dates. I don't think that's what our sages meant. At some point, you have to see that it might not work. Sages say that a person should check a girl's siblings. You see her siblings, you know what kind of person her children are going to be, what kind of person she is. That's not always true. It's very often true. It's not always true. Here we'll have a fine example. Rivka has a brother who's a lowlife, Lavan, and she herself is a wonderful person. We'll see that they're opposites. Rivka wants to give and Lavan wants to take. It's not a 100% true, our sages say, but there is a certain element of truth, and there is a tremendous frequency of truth too. I mean, before a person says it's not always true, a person should know that it's going to have a very high percentage of application. What our sages say, it's rare that our sages say something and they mean 100%. But the question is, I wouldn't be too quick to forego what they said. Meaning they do have more experience than us, and they did derive it from the Psukim. So we have many guidelines when it comes to Shiduchim that we see from our sages, and in every instance we have to know how much weight to give it. So on the one hand, a person has to be honest. People sometimes say, okay, I have this medrash backing me, I have that backing me, and they overlook other things. That's not what we mean. But at the same time, when we put everything together, it's good to sit down with a rav or someone to figure out how much weight should I give each of these guidelines that Chazal gave us. So here Chazal tells us a few things. Chazal say Avram sent away for his family for a shidduch. He wants his son to marry from his own family. And the question is why? We see that when Eliezer shows up to Avram's hometown, he finds Avram's house has idol worship in it. They're still serving idols. So what's the difference if she comes from a house of idol worshippers out in Haran, or the idol worship is going on here in Canaan? Why did Avram say, I want from my family? So one understanding the Ran tells us is that every person has certain traits, and we all have an obligation to better our traits, but we all have a starting point. Where do we start off in life? And we have certain things that are ingrained within us, certain traits that come from the home, and a person has to overcome and develop what he has from the home, but at the same time his starting point is what he has at home. When it comes to philosophies, a person can change. It's very easy. A person learns, a person studies, and a person's philosophies can change as he grows. You could convince a person that this way of living is wrong, this way of living is right, and the person will go with the way he believes. But when it comes to the habits a person has and the traits a person has, that a person gets in the home. And Avram knew that in his home there were good trees. So Avram said, it could be you'll only find a girl that's an idol worshiper. But I'd rather have an idol worshiper from my house who I could teach that this is the way of serving Hashem, and this is the right way, and that she'll change on, than to take a girl from here, the Canaanites, who have bad traits, as we will see in next week's parasha. There I'm not, I won't have what to work with. It's true, every person has an obligation to better their traits, but the starting point is far lower down. Yeah.
Avram didn't necessarily have people in his family added.
So that we'll see in a second.
Okay.
In a second we'll discuss what traits we see when we encounter Avram's family.
You're speaking to the Canaanite sexual immorality, right?
Not specifically, no. We're talking about being a kind person, taking guests into the house, helping people, liking people. We're not talking about specifically their actions when it came to having faithful marriages. That probably too, but that doesn't seem to be the main point. So that's one understanding, that Avram was adamant to get a wife from his family for that sake. We know that the Canaanites were cursed and they behaved in such a fashion. And that's an answer you all should be jumping down my back saying, well, what do you mean? Avram himself married Hagar, right? How come Avram is so concerned to get a wife for his son from his own family, yet he himself married Hagar? Oh, so the answer is that the major problem was with the Canaanite, and she's not a Canaanite. But that's a problem. What I just said until now was written in the Rishonim. Should I bother you with a question I have?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, but I don't have an answer for it. Avram married Hagar, who came from Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim is the son of Ham, who is the son of Canaan. So I don't know.
I think Ham is the son of Canaan.
You say it in prayer every day. You say, God took us out of Admat B'nei Cham, the land of the sons of Cham. Mitzrayim is the son of Cham, I'm sorry. And,
no, I understand that. I understand that. How can Cham be the son of Canaan?
I'm sorry. Cham is the father of Canaan. I'm sorry. You're right. So he just answered the question. Right. As I was talking, I had the question and he answered it. Very good, right? Ham was the father of Mitzrayim. Very good. Okay, it was worth posing the question. We got an answer. You want something? Very good. Okay, you know, that reminds me of the old joke. There was a rabbi who asked the students. He said, how could it be that a tzaddik like Avram has a brother who's a rasha like Nimrod? So the students all try to answer this answer, that answer, and then finally one says, but Nimrod wasn't Avram's brother. She says, yeah, that's a good answer. Does anyone else have another answer? Some answers, like, they're just so good, you don't need another answer. That's a good answer. Okay, very good. Yeah?
How many animals did Moshe take?
What?
How many animals did Moshe take?
Oh, very good. Okay. So let's continue. So what are the lessons we see from here? One lesson is that one is supposed to try and get a family with good traits. And that the traits, when one is looking for a shidduch, it's obviously one's looking for a good Jewish girl from a good Jewish home, and the main point is the traits. We want to see, when we say a good Jewish home, so number one is Jewish, number two is what's good. Good is good traits. Avram didn't have that option, so Avram went back to his family or to Mitzrayim. But the today when one is looking, obviously when one is looking, that's what one is looking for. Next point, our sages say that Avram sends his servant out to his own family. One should ideally try to find someone who has a similar background to himself. Meaning, if a person has a choice of two girls and one comes from a different country and one comes from a similar background as his own, one should prefer a similar background. And this answers also a question that guys always ask. Is it better to marry a girl who's also Balas Tshuva, or preferably marry a girl who's from birth? So this is what we mentioned in the past, that there are definitely advantages to marrying a girl who's gone through the same process, because you'll have more understanding, just like if you're not from the same country. Obviously there are also advantages to marrying a from birth girl. And as I tried to be exact on, I don't think Chazal meant that if a person has only one option before him, is being offered one girl who comes from a foreign country, a person will say, well, she has a different background than me, I won't date her. If he's 19, he could say that. If he's 23, if he's 27, I'm not sure he should say that.
23?
So it depends. If he's been studying, if he's been from birth, and by 23 he should be going out and getting married. If he's just started discovering life, so then he shouldn't be going out yet. 23 is nothing. Like everything in life, yes, it depends on where you're holding. Okay, yeah, sorry, guys.
Why is it so preferable to marry someone with the same background? Just because of the customs in the household? Or?
No, because there are certain normalcies that go with the place you live in. We mentioned once that there was an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi person talking at a wedding, and obviously this is a joke. I'm not sure if it's a true story or not. A person cannot derive generalizations from this, but this is the way the story goes. I think it was a true story. So the Ashkenazi, the Sephardi asks the Ashkenazi, why don't you want your daughter to date my son? So the Ashkenazi tells him, because we have different perspectives on the relationship between husbands and wife. So the Sephardi tells him, what do you mean? For the exact same, what do you mean? I respect my wife, you respect your wife, my wife respects me, your wife respects you. So he says, I'll show you. Let's both decide we're leaving this simcha now. We're standing at a mitzvah, at a wedding, let's decide that we're leaving now. So the Ashkenazi says, watch. He goes to his wife, he says, honey, let's go. It's time to go. So she says, sure. And she goes and continues talking to her friend. 5 minutes later, he comes back to her and he says, honey, you know, it's time to go. Maybe we'll leave. So she says, yeah, I'm on my way. And 5 minutes later, she's still talking to her friend. 5 minutes later, he says, you know, we really have to get going. It's getting late. She says, you're 100% right. I'm coming. To make a long story short, a half hour later, he turns to his Friday friend and says, now you go tell your wife we're leaving, let's see. So he goes to his wife and says, we're going now, yeah? She says, yeah, and she's with him, and they leave. She says, you see the difference? that's a small example. And now there are...
Why don't you see
him talking? There's a joke they say that, you know, when we put up the mezuzah, so... we put the mezuzah in a slant because there's an opinion that says the mezuzah should be standing straight. There's an opinion that says the mezuzah should be lying down. One opinion says it should be vertical. One opinion says it's horizontal. So we do in the middle. So that way our mezuzah is good according to all opinions. So they like to say that this teaches you in a household. When you enter the house, you have not a compromise. You have one opinion that says like this, one opinion says like that. Find it like somewhere in the middle. So what someone once told me a joke, he said, so we could extrapolate on that, that that's why Spartan have it straight up, because there's one way in the house. but you can't make generalizations. Every husband has to care, but there are certain normalcies that are accepted in different cultures. When it comes to I always say the example, I came to Israel and I sat in yeshiva and I saw my friends would take bread and put it down on the table. I never saw such a thing before. You sit down and eat bread off the table. The table's filthy, how could you do that? I'd stand there balking, how could they do that? And they'd just come and sit and eat off the table. And we're not talking about a table that was cleaned. So imagine a guy gets married and his wife puts him down the bread on the table. So it sounds like a small thing, but there are going to be thousands of things like this in every household, regardless who you marry. When you take someone from a different culture, then you can't even begin to think what to cover in your dates, because you're coming from two different worlds. That's a small example, relatively. When you're coming from two different cultures, there are going to be huge examples. I could give tens of different examples, but I don't see the point. Yeah.
One more.
What do you do if you come from a really weird mix of cultures?
So, One thing is, you try to learn the culture you're living in, meaning you're going to be dating and marrying probably here in Israel. So try to learn the culture around you. You're living here a little bit. Try to adapt. People are very hard to adapt at everything. That's our nature. This is who I am. Take me, love me how I am. But the way we should be is looking around and seeing what's normal around us. And like we said before, and I say this many times, and I'm still going to say it many times, go to people's houses. Go see Shabbos meals by people's houses. Every Shabbos you could get a meal out, go out and learn from that. See how other people are behaving. The best time to learn is now. And take mental notes. Sit there and that's... I always tell you, you could learn more at a Shabbos table by someone's house than you could learn in a class. I'm a firm believer in that. Now, beyond that, when you do get married, so you have to be extra patient and extra understanding and to speak a lot, to have open lines of communication. Now that's easier said than done, but at least it's been said, and now it just has to be done.
It's really funny. It's really, really funny because I was listening to this shiur on my computer right now. When I figured out, well, there's a lecture right now going down. And you were saying the shiur, the same thing. You took your wife to other Shabbat tables, you know?
This is the one I say that, yeah.
I think I put that there.
Yeah. So, but I'm sorry, I just have one more little thing.
Yeah?
You know, I like chicken akito, not Spartan. So, think there's a possibility or a chance or whatever.
Why not? For sure, for sure, a person who's Sephardi can marry an Ashkenazi girl, but a person has to be prepared to adopt some of the normalcies in Ashkenazi homes. There's going to be compromise.
First, meet your Ashkenazi mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Of course, Google it, stuff like that.
Okay, yeah.
Well, we're at Sukkot, I was with some friends up north, and they wanted to go to a bakery. And I said, I can't, I have to go to the Sukkot, there was no Sukkot around. So the owner of the store, he said, well, if you're Sephardi, then you don't have to. And he was telling about his daughter, who's actually married. Sephardi guy and did Hatrat Nedarim so that she could take on all the Sephardi customs.
The custom in Yerushalayim, and that's become, I think, the custom in Israel, is to do Hatarat Nedarim when a girl gets married to adopt her husband's custom, but it doesn't seem like she has to. It seems like it's automatic that a girl adopts her husband's customs. Not all rabbis agree to this, but even those who don't agree to this will agree that if she does Hatarat Nedarim, that she can and should adopt her husband's customs. Hatarat Nedarim is when a person can null his vow. Custom has the halachic binding power of a vow. When a person takes on a vow, will do something, so he has to do it. So too, when a person has a certain custom, he has to do that custom like a vow. So just like one can annul a vow by doing Hatrat Nedarim, one can annul Minagim by doing Hatrat Nedarim. That's a good question to be asked one-on-one. Let's continue. So Avram sends his elder servant and he sends him out to find a wife. And the elder servant has taken a vow that he'll only bring a girl from Avram's family, as we discussed. And Avram goes out to the family of Nahar. Nahar is Avram's brother, to go and see what children he has. Eliezer, who is the servant, is a very wise servant who knows how to tell from people's features what kind of person they are. And Eliezer knows what kind of girl he wants for his master's son, for Yitzchak. And he turns to God, and he's one of the four people who ask him properly. Eliezer, Kalev, Yiftach, and forgot who the fourth was, Shaul. Right? So Eliezer asks God, he says, I'm going to be by the water, and I'm going to ask for a drink. And the girl who shows me that she wants to do extra kindness, she says, I'll give you to drink, I'll give the camels to drink. She's the one who's fitting for my master. Now, why is Eliezer standing outside the city? Why doesn't he go into the city and do some research? So Eliezer knows that if he enters the city with all of his wealth, and he enters the city and people know he's looking for a shidduch, and he enters the city and he looks at a girl when she's under her parents' tutelage, well, then she's going to do what her parents tell her. They'll tell her, be a nice girl. She'll be a nice girl. They'll tell her, give him the drink. She'll give him the drink. They tell her, give him extra drinks. She'll give him extra drinks. That shows nothing about the girl. He wants to test her on neutral territory. So Eliezer purposely waits out of the city. As he approaches the city, as he approaches the well that's outside the city, the girls of the city come out towards him. And our sages say that if one approaches the city and he sees the girls of the city approaching him, he knows that's a sign from heaven, he will be successful. And so happens. Eliezer looks and he's looking for three things when he's looking for a wife. He's looking at her looks, because she should be good looking for Yitzchak. And this you guys should know, we've mentioned this in our dating class, you have to choose a girl that her looks are appealing to you. You don't have to think she's a beauty queen, but you do have to at least not feel bad with the way she looks. Find it presentable, find it decent. Every person has his level of what's the minimum, but you don't. No one needs a beauty queen. Maybe some people do, I don't know.
But how do you know what's reasonable?
So long as you don't feel badly with it. If you feel it's okay, that's enough.
No, man. But I can feel bad if I don't let a girl who doesn't look like Naomi Campbell, for example.
I don't either know, whatever. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is my standards can be very high, but
so
I think there's more
math
problem than
theirs. No, so we'll discuss that, but not now. Let's continue. Eliezer is looking for someone who looks good, that he could see when she comes from the right family, and that's something you guys should know. The right family means a lot. You do bring a lot of your family with you to the house, and that's why Avram tells him, find someone from my family. That he'll be able to find out after he chooses the girl, and who has good traits. Well, good traits, he could only test out here outside the city, because here her parents aren't telling her what to do. So he sees one girl that when she approaches the well, the water comes towards her, and he asks her to give her a drink, to give him a drink, and she says, drink my master. And here he sees that she has derech eretz, she calls him my master. Something to be thought about. People are very quick to call people by their first names. Sometimes you could have a gender in a yeshiva who could be your grandfather and people are calling him Bill or Bob. That's not derech eretz. The man's reached a certain age, he deserves to be called Mr. So-and-so, at least. So our Chazal, the Torah tells us we owe a person a certain amount of respect once he's a certain age. That's one of the things Eliezer's testing her on, that she calls him Shte Adoni. She says, my master, have a drink. She treats him with respect. She sees an old man coming from the way, she offers him a drink. She offers to give his camels to drink. And when he sees this, he asks her, who's child are you? Where? What family are you from? She tells him. He sees she's from the right family, and he gives her the gifts. Now, he asks her, you have room to house me and my entourage? And she says, sure, there's enough room for you, there's enough hay for you and your cattle. How could she do this? She's the kid. She's inviting guests into the house. So I think the answer is that she knew, this is my own shot, but I think this is probably shot in the Pesukim, that Rivka knew that this is the way her house ran. That if she'd come home and tell her father there was a stranger by the way and he needed a place to stay, and I didn't invite him in, her father would tell, why didn't you invite him in? You see a guy who needs a place to stay. You know we're always open to guests. And that is what he wanted to see. He wanted to see that this is a house that does achnas asarchem, that the daughter could feel confident telling him, come, you need a place to stay, I'm sure my parents will be happy to have you.
Who's, yeah. Who's his entourage? Like, who's with him?
We don't know. It says, Hanashim asher imo.
We're assuming that he's not trailing 10 camels by himself, though, right?
The psukim say there were men with him.
There were.
We know there were men with him. Yeah.
How does one water 10 camels?
Good question. I could, whatever I tell you, I don't know. I've heard many answers, none of them I don't understand any of them. I don't know. Yeah.
Barbanel, or I'm not sure if it was Ben Ezra, who says by the simple verse it seems that Lavan didn't do anything wrong. His actions should be praised. but it seems like everyone else thinks he's like he was being greedy and.
Good. So we'll get to that right now. So what does Rivka do? Rivka sees a guy who needs something to eat and drink. She offers him. He needs a place to stay. She offers him a place to stay. He tells her. He thanks God, the God of Avram, who Avram had promised him would help him along the way, and he sees that that's come true. And he tells her, "I'm here for a shidduch. Please bring me to your parents." She runs home and tells them the news. She comes home with these beautiful pieces of jewelry that he gave her. What does the pasuk stress, Michael? Vayehi kir'ot et anezim. Pasuk lamed. When Lavan saw the nose ring, when he saw the bracelets that his sister was wearing, and when he heard all that her sister had said, then he ran out to greet the person. The pasuk is telling us very clearly that he was not interested in being a hospitable person.
But he was.
The pasuk is stressing that what did he do after he saw all this guy's giving gifts? Then he ran out to greet him. Pasuk stresses that.
But you just said that, you know, that she felt confident that she could bring a guy as a guest because the house was open.
Lavan is her brother, he's not her father.
Wasn't her father killed? Doesn't the pasuk say the father was
killed? Wait, we'll get to that. Wait. Jumping ahead. So Rivka comes and tells the story back home. Her brother Lavan runs out and he invites the man in. So the man comes in, Eliezer comes in, and Lavan opens up the bags and helps him unload. And then he gives him to eat, and Eliezer says, "I can't eat till I talk." And he explains, because I'm Avram's servant. What does he have to do explaining for? So our sages tell us that if you know you have a fault, lay it on the table. You know you're lacking. He's coming in like he's this wealthy merchant. So he says, "Wait, let's call a spade a spade. Let's begin with telling you exactly who I am. This isn't all mine. I'm a servant. This is all my master's." But there's another understanding that Eliezer comes and they're putting before him food. So eat while it's hot. Come on, they just gave you to eat. Eliezer says, "No, I can't do that. I'm on a mission. My responsibility is to first take care of what my master wants, then I could eat." So he has to explain why is it that he has to speak before he'll eat the food that they're offering him. Which teaches us their hearts. You come to a person's house and the woman of the house wants to offer you hot food. Don't sit there talking and ignoring the food and delaying the meal. Very often people could come and you haven't seen the person for a long time, so you could schmooze with him a long time. And meanwhile, the woman is waiting, the food's getting cold. If she prepared the food, their heart is to eat it. Unless, like Eliezer, you can't. You have a mission you have to do first. Now, officially our class is supposed to end now, so I was asked to announce that whoever wants to leave may leave. And we'll continue a short while to try and run through finishing the parsha. The door? No, seriously. Class is over. Whoever wants could go. We'll continue, and whoever wants can stay. So he tells them, "I'm the servant, and my master's son was given all of his wealth. Just before you guys disappear, tomorrow night we have instead of Friday. Friday morning I can't make it to class, so tomorrow night whoever wants, it's a free night, but whoever wants to could come at 6:45. We'll have 45 minutes of halacha to make up for Friday's halacha class. We'll do the Rambam's intro to Chelek and halacha." So the Eliezer says, "My master is very, very wealthy, and he gave his son Yitzchak all of his wealth, and he sent me to find him a shidduch. So I come here," and he tells him the whole story, how God made him especially successful. He just got there, and Rivka comes out to greet him, and he asks her for a drink. She passes the test just after he asked God for a sign. He gets the sign, and he tells them all this to try and convince them God really wants this to happen. Which tells you something about how you offer a shidduch. If you want to offer a shidduch, learn from Eliezer. When Eliezer tries to offer the shidduch, what does he do? He shows them how God wants this to work. He shows them how everything matches. He says, "I just finished asking God for the sign, and she walked up, she passed all the tests, I gave her the gift. And now, if you're willing to do as you see God wants, let her marry." Now, Avram had told Eliezer that he's praying God will send his angel before him and help him succeed. So one understanding is that, like we see, he was successful. Another understanding says that what angel was sent before him? The angel of dreams. And the night before, everyone in the family was having dreams that he's going to show up and that Rivka is supposed to marry Yitzchak. So when he comes in, they all say, oh, God sent you, yeah. We'll do what you want. Yeah, Ari. Not necessarily, but I could tell a person, you know, it seems that you guys really match because A, B, C, and D. So,
but subconsciously, I think Chazal said that he wanted Isaac for his own daughter.
That's true. Yeah, we mentioned that before, right? So,
but how could he
So Chazal seemed to say that it wasn't subconscious. He told Avram he wants it, and Avram told him it's not going to happen. That's why Avram made him take a vow. Don't go back on our agreement. Don't bring my...
Moses is so praised by Hashem. The servant of my servant is a praise to him. And we see how praiseworthy Eliezer is. How come he's not good enough for his daughter to marry?
Because he comes from Nimrod, who comes from Canaan, who is cursed. Avram says, I want a daughter, a girl from the family of Shem, not from Canaan.
So, although he's praiseworthy, he's not good enough to...
He attained great heights. He made it to Gan Eden alive. But he's still part of a cursed family. He's still there's still the curse of Canaan hovering over him. So now Lavan and Bsuel answer. So Chazal tells us, this shows us how disrespectful Lavan was. A son isn't supposed to speak before his father. A son isn't even supposed to say, I agree, Dad. Because by saying, I agree, you're saying, I have the final say. I'm one to authorize or not authorize whether what you're saying makes sense. There's another understanding that says that Bsuel was already an old man and Lavan was running the show. So Lavan answers first and he says, whatever God says, that's what's going to be. Yeah, Ari. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
How many generations was Eliezer after Ham in Canaan?
I don't remember.
Do you like?
I think it was Ham, Cush, Nimrod, Eliezer.
Wow. Is there a point where your descendants don't have that same influence on your school, especially in negative cases, like in Jesus, three generations. Four generations.
Don't they say the Haman's grandsons or grandsons are?
I don't know. Eliezer gives gifts, and he gives gifts primarily to Lavan and to the mother because he knows they're going to be his big challenge. Now here comes in what Jeff pointed out before, that we have a Medrash that says they wanted to poison Eliezer and take all his wealth, and then an angel came and switched the plates, and Besuel, the father, ended up drinking the poison, and that's why he's not around for the rest of the story.
But hold on, he wasn't around for the beginning of the story. That's what I'm saying. How does...
Look at Pasuk Nun.
Okay.
Vayan Lavan uv'Suel. Suel was there.
It says
B'suel. Okay. Lavan and B'suel answered Eliezer. So B'suel was there in the beginning of the story. Yeah.
We just skip something? Who put poison in the cup with the kessel with the metal on it?
I don't know.
So it's either Levin or Besuel. We know probably it's either or.
Right.
So who gets killed?
Besuel.
Okay.
But
it was meant for... It's not so nice to do that to a guest, right? But it was intended for... it was intended for Eliezer.
Right. Okay, I don't know. It's a good question.
And then it gets rebounded back into...
To Besuel, yeah. So, Besuel really wanted this marriage to take place because Yitzchak was his cousin, it was his family. It wasn't his wife's family. Lavan had no interest in this marriage. So that's why he has to really give them the gift. And really, when it comes time to leave, they're the ones that make a fuss. He wants to go. They say, give her a year. That's the normal time. You give a girl to prepare a dowry, to prepare what she needs. So he says, what do you mean? You see, God wants us to work. Don't detain her. She could get more at Avram's house than you guys could ever give her. Let her get, she'll have whatever she needs there. So they said, let's ask Rivka. And that's what our sages say, they don't marry a woman unless she wants. That's why even though a father may marry off his daughter, I have a girl who's 9 months old. Halachically, I have the authority. If one of you guys want to marry her, you could pay me a dollar and she's yours. But I wouldn't give her away because the Gemara curses any person. No, for a lot more than that. The Gemara says you're not allowed to marry off a girl before she knows what she wants. She has to say, this is the person I want. So that's what they did over here. They call over Rivka and they say, do you want to go? And Rivka says, yeah, I want to go. So they send her away and they bless her and they get Ruach HaKodesh for the minute that they're blessing her. They use the same term that Avram used, that God used for Avram. When God blessed Avram in the end of the last six parashat, the Akedah, God told him your offspring should inherit their enemies, and they used almost an identical blessing when they blessed Rivka. And from here we have the custom that we bless a girl at the chuppah. Yekis still have this custom. It used to be that the rabbis would bless the girl at the right before the chuppah. The rabbis used to be the one to cover her with the veil, not the chassan. Today we have the custom that the chassan covers her with the veil, and then some have the custom that her father and then his father give her a blessing before she goes to the chuppah. And this stems from here that they blessed Rivka before she went to marry Yitzchak. And the original custom was that the rabbis would bless a girl before she would walk down to the chuppah. Yeah?
Wouldn't the fact that they asked her what she wants to do, wouldn't that confirm that she wasn't really three and she might have been asked by the Muslim?
Could be. There are opinions that say she was 3 or 13, 14.
Well, because a 3-year-old, how could she have the mentality, the capability of making a decision?
That's true that it seems a little bit far-fetched to think that a 3-year-old can make such a decision, but it also seems far-fetched that a 3-year-old could draw water for so many camels, and it also seems a little bit far-fetched that a 14-year-old would need a nursemaid, because it says she took the one who was nursing her with her. So we have things pointing both ways. Oh, so you could say that wet nurse doesn't mean literally wet nurse. It means the one who really took care of her. Okay, could be. So you could also say that she was 3 and 3-year-olds in those days had greater intellect and greater ability than nowadays. I don't know. That's what they want to say when the Pasuk praises Sarah, that she was beautiful at 20, like at 7, that just like in those days, women could have children at 8 years old, as we will prove from the Pesukim later on, that women were able to bear children at 8 years old. That's a Gemara. The Gemara proves it from the Pesukim. So too, women reached their peak of beauty at 7, 8 years old. And then the Pasuk is praising her. At 20, she was beautiful like the peak of beauty at 7. So if they're reaching their peak of beauty at 7 and having children at 8, then maybe at 3 they were also making wiser decisions. I don't know.
Men weren't men until 13?
No. Men were men younger also. Men were men, I think, at 9. 8 or 9, the Gemara says. What?
Isn't this weird?
Good question. So the Gemara says that the nature changed. The nature of people changed. That in ancient times, people matured younger. That's what the Gemara says. And then we see it. We'll see it from Sukkim later on. So he takes her and he brings her back. And on their way back, she sees Yitzchak walking out. Yitzchak is walking out in the late afternoon. Our sages say that's when he instituted the prayer of Mincha. An easy way to remember which prayer each one of the Avos instituted is you take the second letter of their name. Avraham, the second letter is Beis, that's Boker, the morning prayer. Yitzchak, the second letter is Tzadi Tzoharaim, he instituted the afternoon prayer. And Yaakov, the second letter is Ayin, that's Arvit, he instituted the evening prayer. So Yitzchak is going out to the field to talk. Our sages say to talk means to talk with God, he's instituting the afternoon prayer. And Rivka looks out and she sees a man who took note of them and is headed towards them. So she hops off the camel. All kinds of midrashim about what exactly happened when she hopped off the camel. She hears that he is her bride, he is her groom, so she takes the veil and covers herself. From here we have the custom of the Badekin, that a woman covers herself. Our sages say, we learn from here, that a woman is supposed to be tsanua and cover herself even when she's engaged. People sometimes think we're engaged, so now we're free with one another. No, till you're married, or a woman is supposed to try and show extra modesty, just like Rivka. She hears that that's the man she's about to marry, nonetheless, she maintains extra modesty, she covers herself.
How about the custom about a bride at her wedding shouldn't cover herself until she's actually married? And here you can see it.
So Michael is asking a question which involves a lot of introduction to even explain the question, let alone give the answer. So Michael, I'll be happy to deal with it if you want after class, if you want on a Thursday night. Your choice. So the servant comes back and he tells Yitzhak everything that happened. And again, he's a good shatchan. He tells Yitzhak, look, it's from God. I just walk out, she walks out towards me, I just speak to God, and I set up the sign, and here she is. He brings her to the tent of Sarah, his father, and then he loves her. Our sages say that when she came to the tent, so he married her in that tent, and that tent was a special tent, that was Sarah's tent. They left it until Sarah's replacement, so to speak, Rivka would walk onto the scene. They didn't inhabit that tent, they didn't use it. So when Rivka walks in, the blessings that had always been there came back. When Sarah had been in the tent, there was always a candle lit. She'd light it on Friday, and it lasted to the next Friday. She'd bake challah, and there'd be enough leftover challah to the next Shabbos. And there was a cloud hovering over the tent. And when Rivka walked in, the same miracles started again. So he saw that she's making it again like the tent of Sarah. There's a beautiful medrash here that says that when Yitzhak married Rivka, he brought her to the tent of Sarah, his mother. The Medrash says that Sarah came down from heaven and looked on onto their marriage to see Yitzchak happy with his wife Rivka. That's what the Medrash says. That's why it says he brought her to the tent of Sarah, his mother. That Sarah actually came to see he was happy. After Yitzchak's married, so Avram took care of his son. He takes care of himself. He gets remarried. Our sages say, where was Yitzchak coming from when he was out in the field? He was going to get a wife. He was going to bring Hagar back. Now Hagar is called Keturah. Our sages say because she had beautiful actions and she kept herself tied. Like Keturah is Keshura, tied up, waiting for Avram to take her back in all these years. She had spent some 23 years waiting for Avram. What's the big deal? So think about who Hagar is. She's the daughter of the king of Egypt. Many kings want to marry her, because this is good politically for them. You marry the king's daughter, king of Mitzrayim's daughter, that's very good. So Hagar said, I'm not interested in any shidduch, I'm waiting for Avram. And that's the great tzaddikus Hagar. This medrash seems to learn she was. Avram, at the end of his life, sends away the children from all the other wives he had, which are, according to one understanding, he had many pilagshim. According to one understanding, it's only Keturah, it's only Hagar. And he gives them gifts and sends them away to the east. Our sages say he taught them the secret name of Tumah, the name that, just like we know, there's a holy name with which one can change things in nature, so too there's an impure name. And he gave them that secret. That's what people want to say the Chinese or the Far Eastern cultures have, that they are Avram's children from these women or this woman, and that this is the secret that Avram gave them. And he sent them away so there would be no fight. It would be clear that Yitzchak is his sole inheritor. And when he passes away, he is buried by Yitzhak and Yishmael, his son. Our sages derive from here that Yishmael did tshuva, because he, even though he was the elder, he let Yitzhak go first, because he recognized that Yitzhak, who Yitzhak was. So he let Yitzhak go first in the burial. And then the Torah records at the end of our parsha the offsprings of Yishmael. So, Yishmael, gentlemen? Yeah.
What did Abraham teach to his servants who he sent to the east?
The children that he had from Hagar, he taught them the secret name of impurity with which one can change nature, with which one can there is a name of God's holy name, and there is a name of that's called the impure name, the name of Tumah, which with which one can also do all kinds of miraculous things, but doing it through impurity, not through purity.
Why would he teach people that?
Oh, I don't know.
Because he was not going to teach them the name of Hashem, you know?
I don't know. I don't begin to understand these concepts, but they exist. So you should know them. I don't know beyond that.
Okay, whoever wants to live for him, that's it.
Okay, we were asked to have a Dvar Torah. in each parsha. Eliezer comes, and Eliezer is only identified by name one time. And then we begin by encountering Eliezer as Avdo Zekan Beito, Avram's servant, the elder of his house. And as we continue, Eliezer adopts a different name. And that is that when Eliezer shows up to Lavan's house, Lavan's family, he is identified as Ha'ish. So long as he is out in Haran, he is identified by the Pesukim as Ha'ish.
Ish.
And when he gets back to Avram, next to Avram, he's called Ha'eved. And this shows us that as great as Eliezer was, next to Avram, he was only a servant. When he showed up next to other people, he was a man. He was considered the man. Sometimes a person has a position, and based on his position, he feels like he's second in command. A person has to know that sometimes you're second in command, sometimes you're at the bottom rung, and sometimes you're at the top. You guys are here at Machon Meir, you're learning, so you're learning. Here are your students. You're going to leave Machon Meir, people are going to look up to you. You have a responsibility. People are looking at you, and outside, when you go back to your communities, could be next to all your friends, you're Ha'ish. Could be over here, yeah, you're students, you're learning, you constantly are reminded how much you don't know, because each class you suddenly say, hey, I didn't know that, I didn't know that. But when you walk out of here, people are looking up to you. When I was with my classmates, so a lot of guys, I felt, were looking up to me, so I didn't have a choice. My father smokes, my grandfather smokes, and I very much wanted to smoke, but I knew that if I smoke, all my classmates would say, he's smoking, it's not such a bad thing. So I felt like I can't. So that's what helped me for many years from smoking, because I felt they're looking up to me. I'm not a rabbi, I'm not anything, but to them they look up to me. So what can I do? So I have a responsibility. And the same thing is true. You guys are going back. You have to think about what you do, not only in terms of how you feel you are. You also have to think, what are other people thinking I am? And that's a certain responsibility. People are looking at you, be it your parents or be it your friends or the people in the community. People will know you learned for a period of time. You do have a responsibility. They look at you differently. Sometimes it could be that you're going to Tel Aviv with a yarmulke on your head. No one knows who you are, but they see you're the one with the kippah, so they look at you differently. Friends of mine told me they got to the army, they were the only ones with the kippah, so all the halachic questions were posed to them. They said, you're the religious one, you should know this. So what they didn't know, they had to verify. But it also meant they have to live up to a higher standard. You have to know, you're wearing a kippah, you're wearing a yarmulke, the world looks at you differently. Could be that in certain places you feel like Eliezer next to Avram was Ha'evet, but in other places you're Ha'ish. When Eliezer shows up in Mesul's house, he's Ha'ish, he's the man. So every one of us has times when we feel like we're at the bottom, and there are times when we have to know our responsibility is everyone's looking at us, so we're at the top. So, Shabbat Shalom.